All right, this week in Retronauts, we are not talking about Olivia Newton-John. Everyone, and welcome to the Retronauts panel here at Long Island Retro Gaming Expo. Did I get that name right?
I think so.
Excellent. And we are here to talk about something incredibly obscure. If you came in thinking this was going to be about Dragon's Lair, the Don Bluth produced Laserdisc game, I'm very sorry. This is Dragon Slayer. Yeah.
The doors are locked from the outside, though, so you're stuck here.
Yeah. So anyway, without further ado, I am Jeremy Parrish, one of the co-hosts of Retronauts.
Hey, it's Bob Mackey.
He's also a co-host of Retronauts. And we have special guests here to join us because they know a lot about this very obscure topic. So please, guys, introduce yourselves.
I'm Kurt Coletta of Hardcore Gaming 101.
And I am Rob Russo, also known as Xerxes from the Hardcore Gaming 101 podcast.
And So, yeah, like I mentioned, we're going to be talking about the Dragon Slayer series. What we've done over the past year or so is had a few different episodes about series and franchises with incredibly convoluted family trees. We had Bubble Bobble, and before that we had Wonder Boy. This might be the series to top them all. So it's kind of like the crowning conclusion to our obscure, complicated family lineage trilogy. And the Dragon Slayer series is one that most people here in the U.S. haven't heard a lot about. It's not a very popular or common or well-known franchise in the States, but in Japan it's been extremely, I wouldn't necessarily say extremely popular, but it was a really landmark release. The series began almost 35 years ago and has been extremely influential on lots of other Japanese RPGs, which, you know, is folded into like modern day indie developed RPGs in Europe and America. So it has like really deep roots and a really, really, I guess, expansive spread and influence, but it largely has gone unknown here in the US. And there's a few reasons for that, which we'll probably cover in pretty good order. But I don't know if you guys have anything you want to add.
Well, the main reason that at least the second Dragon Slayer game, Xanadu, was so well known is because it's one of the best-selling Japanese PC games of all time. I think it's 450,000 copies, which was insane to the how expensive those things were back then.
Right, and also that was the mid-80s, and selling, you know, five digits was doing pretty well. Selling six digits was doing incredibly well, and getting to 500,000 on a PC, like Kurt said, you know, when those systems were thousands of dollars and priced well out of reach for most people was pretty significant. So yeah, the series has done, I think, pretty well for itself. And something we talked about yesterday when we were prepping for this panel was that the series really kind of fed into this sort of underlying game culture that was really prevalent in Japan in the 80s, where there was like this exchange of knowledge among fans. Like, you know, people go on message boards today or share things on Twitter or whatever. But, you know, before that existed, people just kind of shared ideas. And so there was a whole, I guess, not necessarily movement, but it was pretty common to find these games like Dragon Slayer that were full of just incredibly obtuse, obscure secrets and demanded people talk to each other to figure out, how do you beat this game? I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Well, I mean, I guess, so we're in the unenviable position of trying to explain why you should care about a series of action RPGs for computers you've never heard of in a country you probably haven't visited. But think of it this way. Has everybody here heard of like Dragon Quest, Dragon Warrior? Never? Yeah.
The heck?
So that's, anybody here like JRPGs? Show of hands? Ah, okay. Excellent. Okay, so Dragon Slayer is like a series of JRPGs that do everything that JRPGs don't normally do. So they do, JRPGs are kind of like, you look at Dragon Quest, it's kind of like a take on the computer RPG. It's like a take on Ultima Wizardry and other stuff like that. Whereas Dragon Slayer is, each one is its own separate take on what that could have been. and none of them really developed into a genre unto themselves like Dragon Quest did, but they could have, but they probably wouldn't.
Yeah, Rob, you just sent over an interview that you just found between, sorry, what was his name? Kia?
Yoshio. Yeah, Yoshio Kia, and is the creator of Dragon Slayer. And an interview with him and Yuji Horii.
Right, the creator of Dragon Quest. And in that interview, they kind of touched on a point that's something that we've sort of talked about on and off over the past few years on Retronauts, which is that the idea of role-playing games has become pretty much cemented in people's minds as this journey to make numbers get bigger. And that's not really what the RPG was about. The RPG was about, you know, the tabletop RPG was about people getting together, sharing a story together, having an experience, doing improvisational things, not necessarily watching their stats get bigger. I mean, at the end of a classic D&D tabletop quest, your wizard is going to have like 6 hit points. He's not going to be, you know, a million hit points or whatever. That's just not really the focus of classic D&D. But RPGs on video games and computers have pretty much gone in the direction of the numbers, you know, making the numbers get bigger, getting stats and becoming stronger. And it's just, you know, I think because that's what computers do best. They work with numbers. So that's where the focus has gone. But Dragon Slayer, even though there is a lot of that, you know, the numbers get bigger, those games were really kind of designed to focus on that sort of experience, I would say.
In different ways, each one in different ways. And when we actually get into covering the individual games, you'll see how that plays out. Do we want to talk a little bit about, we don't have to, but do you want to talk a little bit about like how Kia and Falcom kind of?
Yeah, actually, it's an interesting story. Like Falcom, you may have heard of, they've created games like Ys and Legend of Heroes. They've been around for 30 plus years. And are still an active force, but they didn't start out as a video game maker.
No, they started out. I actually have their what they were called before. They were called Falcom. Here, I just found this out. They were known as Computerland Tachikawa. So they're in the Tachikawa neighborhood of Tokyo. They were a computer store. They opened their doors, I believe, on March 9th, 1981, and they were mostly an Apple II importer. At the time, Apple II computers were really, really expensive in Japan, and so most people played their games and such on the NEC PC-88 or PC-98. There's a Sharp X1 later.
Right, but the computers made in Japan for Japanese audiences.
Think MSX. Most people are probably familiar with MSX. They're kind of like that, but they're a little bit older. So Yoshio Kia basically got his start by being sort of bumming around that store. And he would code basic games at home, I believe, on his NEC PC 6001, which I didn't hear of until I looked this up. But he brought in a game he coded in BASIC, I believe, called Galactic Wars. And we don't have images up on the slideshow, but if anyone wants to go to my Twitter feed, it's a pinned tweet. It starts out with some of these things. I'm at GCINX on Twitter. The pinned tweet starts a thread that has some images of this time period and some extra information.
So, out of curiosity, has anyone here played a Dragon Slayer game? We've got the two guys front and center. Okay, so a few hands. You may have actually played some without realizing it. Have you played Legend of Heroes, any of those games? That actually started as Dragon Slayer. Legacy of the Wizard for NES and Pazanadu both were spinoffs. Actually, Legacy of the Wizard was actually Dragon Slayer 4 in Japan. So some of these games did kind of trickle over to the U.S. I think the third game, Sorcerian, made it to PCs like really late and in really small numbers.
Oh, that's the fifth game. And that was,
oh my God, I've already
messed
up.
At the time, Sierra Online was looking to the Japanese market to license a bunch of games. And most of the games they published were from Emarts, who later did like the Lunar games. But the one that they got from Falcom was Sorcerian.
Yeah, so some of these games have made it over, but none of them have come under the name Dragon Slayer, even though that's kind of what they're known as in Japan. So, again, it kind of feeds into the obscurity of all of these games. And did you happen to put up the image of the family tree, like all the games?
We forgot.
No, sorry, I promise.
I put together back when I worked for 1UP.com an image that had like all the links and everything and showed which games started where and what they became.
I think it's too big for this planetarium screen.
You wouldn't even be able to see it if we blew it up because there's only like 8 core games, but there's so many spin-offs and branches and ports and what have yous. Oh, yeah. There's a joint between Sega and Falcom, which they brought out a ton of games. And I think one of the only ones that came out here was Popple Mail.
Which is out there. I saw it out there earlier. It's $300 now.
Yeah, you can get a disc-only copy for about $120 from one of the guys here.
Yeah.
I don't think they did it. The thing about Falcom is that they were mostly a PC developer, so they licensed their stuff out a lot. And I think, I don't know, Sony or something like that made the Dreamcast.
Let's actually talk about what Dragon Slayer is. We've kind of danced around it, but the fact is there is no like central definition for Dragon Slayer. It's a bunch of games developed, kind of led, designed by Yoshio Kiya, and he was one of the original employees of Falcom, right?
Once it transferred over from being a computer store to being a software publisher, and probably sometime in 1983, I think, they published his game Cosmic, or not Cosmic Wars, that's a different game, Galactic Wars 1, which never got a sequel, in 1983. That was their first game and his first game. And then they did another game of his called Panorama Island, which is his first RPG, I think, Falcom's first.
Yeah, and so all of these games were designed by him, but they don't have any sort of unifying element to them. The first few games are sort of like top-down games. Then they went sort of side-scrolling platformers, so some with some very strange ideas behind them.
Wouldn't you say the unifying element is cruelty throughout?
But I mean, even toward the end, some of the later ones, like Legend of Heroes, which is a very Dragon Quest-style RPG,
yeah.
That's not really that cool. Then you get into, in the 90s, like there's a strategy RPG. Like none of these games have a story connection. There's a sword called a Dragon Slayer most of the time, but that's about it. It's just kind of a loose connection.
There's a couple of recurring things that you sort of see in them. They're just ideas I think that Kia really liked. Like a couple of the games have a karma system. There's a sort of idea that your characters might not necessarily level up, but your equipment does as you use them over and over. There's sort of small things like that. And if you look at Xanadu and just sort of see the way the graphics are presented, you can sort of see the link between that and Legacy of the Wizard.
Yeah, you can definitely see some connections from time to time. But at the same time, you're like, I don't know, like trying to draw a line from the original Dragon Slayer to Lord of Monarch or something, the strategy RPG, it's really tough. So anyway, the games themselves, the first Dragon Slayer came out under the name Dragon Slayer. That's kind of where, like the one time it made sense. And that was in 1984. And that's sort of an action RPG, sort of a top-down perspective. I've never played the original version because, of course, these games were made for PCs that only came out in Japan in the 80s. So I don't just have any of those laying around. But there was a Game Boy port that I've covered and played. And it pretty much gets the basics. And it's such a big game, and there's no way to save your progress, that it may not actually be possible to finish it on a set of batteries. So some of these games, like, yeah, I don't know. Some of the thinking behind them might have been a little muddled in transition. But it's a very unusual game. It almost reminds me of the puzzle box-pushing game Sokoban, because the main element of the original Dragon Slayer is that you're a hero who has a house, and your house is in the middle of a labyrinth full of monsters, and in order to become stronger, you have to go into the maze and collect equipment and items and things, and then take them back to your house and use those to power up, like you level up when you go back to your house. But you can push your house around through the maze. It's like this, kind of this gentrification project. And it's very unusual. It's very obtuse. And I was not able to finish it. I have no qualms about saying that. It's very confusing and very difficult. I think to get the true ending, you have to beat it without dying. Isn't that correct?
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, if you die, someone told me. That kind of like stops it. Like, is there any way to continue?
Oh, yeah. You can totally continue. But supposedly the way to get the true ending is not to die. But that's more easily said than done, because, of course, the maze is full of monsters. It has the... This is the game that I think invented bump combat. Do you want to talk about that? That's your term.
Bump combat? I don't know.
Oh, I did.
Or whoever wants to talk about bump combat. Someone put that in there.
I can't remember. Maybe. So it may be the first game that has this. But everybody, if you're familiar with the Ys games, they're the first Ys games where you kind of collide with the enemies and that's how you attack them. It's not like Zelda where you press a button to extend your sword. You have to collide with them. And in Ys, it's much more refined than it is in Dragon Slayer or Xanadu. In Dragon Slayer or Xanadu, you're literally just colliding with the enemies.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
This sort of descended from Ultima. I mean, those sort of had that sort of stuff, right? Like the older ones?
A little.
I don't know.
Not to the same degree. This is more of an action sort of thing. Yeah. But you could think like Diablo, and just imagine Diablo without the clicking. Just you bump your dude into the demon or whatever, and whichever has the higher numbers is going to come out ahead. So yeah, that's pretty much the entirety of the game. So you have to bump into enemies that aren't as strong as you, that are a lower level than you. And as you level up, you become stronger, you can more easily kill enemies, and you don't have to worry so much about them sapping your health. The thing is, though, each enemy, like, you have a lot of different appearances for enemies. Each enemy type is a higher level than the next, or the previous one. And whenever you kill an enemy, another one appears in the maze to take its place that is one level higher than the one you just killed. So it's actually pretty easy to go around on a killing spree and create this entire maze full of monsters that you don't actually have the power to kill. So you have to be really careful about playing this game. It's designed, as so many of these Dragon Slayer games are, to kind of make you regret playing, in a sense.
No, I would say it's very deliberate. You should slow down, and if you want to have any chance of enjoying it, play very carefully. But really, a lot of the pleasure of these games is just to go back in time. They're like a time machine. Anybody remember the game Hyde Life? Yeah, this is kind of that same, I would say, like the same species of JRPG, where there's like, there are no rules. It's the Wild West, so to speak, the Wild East. And so they were trying all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, literally, like this quote you pulled up from Kia. With Dragon Slayer, I didn't really have a clear objective in mind as I created it. I wanted players to experience a new style of gameplay. It turned out to be a mess after all. People didn't like it. Yet somehow it just kept going. Many sequels.
I think he's being a little self-deprecating there. It must have sold something. Mm-hmm. Because already he was being known as like the star programmer of Japanese microcomputers. He really was like a big name for that small community of nerds.
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of look at the way this game worked, you have extremely simplistic systems in place. Like, there's only so much you can do with PC games this old. And so the complexity can't really come in how you control your character. So instead it has to come in the way you interact with the world and the systems that are around your character. And so there are things like crosses that you can pick up and carry around, and it will keep enemies from attacking you. But you can only carry one item at a time. So if you're going to carry crosses, that means you have to not carry other things that might be more important in a given situation. So it really comes down to sort of learning the lay of the land, positioning yourself where you need to be, like planning out your strategies, planning out how you're going to advance through the game, not going too fast so that the monsters don't all become impossible to defeat. It's meant to be sort of a long haul experience, I would say. And if you look, this game came out the same year, in 1984, as Namco published Tower of Draga for arcades. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that one. If you just picked up Namco Museum for Switch, it's on there. And if you hadn't played it before, you probably picked that up and died almost immediately and were like, what's happening? Tower of Draga is kind of like, I would say, the arcade approach to this concept, whereas Dragon Slayer is the PC approach. Tower of Draga is like very fast-paced. You stick out your sword and you run into an enemy and you kill it. And it's full of secrets, and it's like you pick up jet boots so you can go really fast, and you're progressing level by level. Whereas Dragon Slayer is this big sprawling maze, and you have to take it more slowly. You're kind of meant to tuck in and play for a few hours at a time. So you sort of get these two very similar looking games on the surface that have very different underlying philosophies. But what they are both united by is the fact that they're incredibly opaque to a casual player and take a lot of mastery and are packed with secrets and strategies that aren't immediately intuitive and really demand that people share tips with each other and kind of socialize. So it does get that, you know, that tabletop RPG socialization experience just in a different way. It's not like you're playing with other people, but instead you play on your own, and then you're like, what's going on? And then you talk to your friends and you figure it out.
Yeah, I believe we were talking yesterday, and somebody said that there were books you could write in the arcade, so it was sort of like a paper Reddit thread about Tower of Draga.
Yeah, I think except friendlier. Much friendlier.
So that's the original Dragon Slayer, and its popularity, I guess, can be debated, depending on whether you believe its creator or not. But he did go on to create another game the following year that would become incredibly successful. That's Xanadu, and like I said, not an Olivia Newton-John reference, but anytime I mention it, someone always sings that song. And this is a very different game in a lot of ways and would be extremely influential. It's more of a... Is it up on the screen? Oh, there you go. Yeah. So it's got the side-scrolling thing, and you're fighting a giant dragon, apparently.
Yeah, there's one of the big things about it was the big boss creatures that you would fight. With a dragon and a big old octopus.
Yeah, so I think it originally came out for the Sharp X1, which is another one of those computers I've never seen, I've only heard about.
Well, one of the main reasons why Xanadu became so popular is there's always been Japanese PC magazines that people could buy and type in magazines, but the industry was starting to really pick up around then. So they would put strategy guides for Xanadu, and that sort of gave it free publicity that like made a feedback loop where people would see this in a magazine, buy it, and it's actually free promotion.
Yeah, so to describe the gameplay, when you see a picture of it, when it comes up, I don't know how you'll know what it is, but it starts out and you're actually, it's like a side-scrolling type thing where you're on, you've got a little character, and there's like a castle, and you go in, you talk to the king, and then it switches to like, you know, I don't know what you call it, like standard like Apple II RPG type thing where you've got like, you're in a tavern, here's the tavern guy, and it's just the whole picture. And they actually copied them originally out of what, the Ultima manual?
Yeah, the Ultima 3 manual. If you look for the original versions of the game and compare them, like they just took it and put it in pixel artwork.
Pretty much.
And there's this whole story behind it where apparently Richard Garriott had visited Japan with the possibility of licensing from the Falcon game to Origin, and when he saw this, he apparently got so furious that the deal fell through.
I think there was a lawsuit.
I think it's kind of a petty thing to get mad about, but you never know. It's one of these things that if anybody had ever interviewed Richard Garriott, it would be a fun thing to ask.
They weren't great.
If you've ever played the Xanadu for NES, then you would recognize the way Xanadu begins. You know, it starts out with the town, like you said, and you talk to the king, get some money, and go into the shops and so forth. Like, I think Xanadu actually started as a Famicom port of Xanadu and then mutated into something like an entirely new game.
I think
a more accessible game.
Yeah, I think what happened was they had licensed it to Hudson, because it was one of the most popular RPGs on there. And then when they actually tried to make it suitable for a Famicom audience, which was broader and younger, they were just like, this is totally unworkable. And then they saw that Zelda 2 was popular at the time and just made their own Zelda 2 type game.
Yeah, when Hudson Soft, the creators of, or not the creators of Adventure Island, but you know, when Hudson Soft thinks your game is too difficult in Byzantine for the audience, you know there's an issue there. Mm-hmm. but if you're familiar with Xanadu, like almost nothing else applies to the original. When you go down,
there's swords.
Yeah.
There's monsters and stuff.
Yeah. But you go down into a cave after that, and like the king gives you money. You use the money to basically build your character. So you go to like the vitality store, and the vitality guy gives you vitality points, and then you go et cetera. And then so you have to decide what your character is going to be like exactly down to the point, and you have no idea how that's going to apply to the rest of the game. Then you go down to the dungeon, and there's a copy protection thing where if you copy the game from your friend or somewhere, you won't know how to get to the next part of the maze. And you'll just loop endlessly. It's like the last dungeon.
Is that explained in the manual or something?
I would assume so. I did not learn it that way. I was very confused. But you just, all you got to do is like you go five steps at the bottom of the tunnel to the left, and then you go, and then you move back over to the right, and there's like a shop, and from there you go into the dungeon, and then the dungeons are like different levels, I think. There's like big.
Oh, they're sort of set out in a grid. They can scroll in different directions, and there's different enemies that you could. Whenever you crash into them, it goes to a separate screen. It's like a bump combat sort of thing, like the other games.
You see like a guy being like surrounded by skeletons up there. That's what that is on the slideshow.
Yeah. All right, so all of this is kind of skirting around the most horrible thing about this game, which is the karma system, which sounds good on, you know, a principle. Like, you don't want to be a bad guy. You want to be a good guy and save the planet. But this is maybe not how you should necessarily implement a karma system.
Right.
No. Drinking poison gives you good karma.
Well, it lowers your bad karma.
Exactly.
So, and it hurts you, and it's, so it's like you're doing like some kind of ascetic penance, like a monk of some kind. But you get
sense.
It, yeah, kind of, I guess. You have to, yeah. So you get, I think, more increases in karma points is bad in this one.
No, it's, well, you want to keep it at a level where it's not too bad, because otherwise I don't think you can like level up, or there's certain areas that you can't go into if your karma is too bad.
So if you kill regular monsters, you've got two kinds of monsters in the game, although you can't tell them apart. Some of them are bad monsters, and killing them doesn't hurt your karma. But some of them are good monsters, and they do hurt your karma if you kill them. And they still attack you. They will just attack you like any other monster, but they're good. So I don't know what the... And you have to kill them. Like, it's just, you know, don't you? Or can you just leave?
I mean, it's probably an essential.
I just racked up karma. And then the only way to get your karma points down, I think, is to drink the karma improving potion.
Yeah, the poison potion. There's also a food system like a lot of those RPGs, so you need to keep yourself fed. But the big rub about the game is that everything is limited. Like, there are only so many enemies in the game and only so much experience points. And so eventually, if you just stumble around without knowing what you're doing, you just run out of resources or find yourself too weak to go anywhere.
And as cruel as that sounds, that probably took more effort to implement than it would have done to just have random drops and random enemies. And this was very intentional on Kia's part.
Yeah, I mean, people like to bag on BioWare games for having simplistic karma systems like the Renegade Paragon thing and Mass Effect. But seriously, give me that any day over this completely opaque system where you have like you have to do things and you don't know if it's going to be good or bad and how you have to recover from it, and that's absolutely mandatory to beat the game.
It reminds me more of Ogre Battle, kind of the more arbitrary morality.
Oh man, this is where Matsuno got his ideas.
And I guess we can move on from Xanadu. There's not like you need to, oh, don't you also need like a good karma to level up? Like you have to go to
certain areas we need to.
So you're good. You're held back in all kinds of ways by mechanics you don't totally understand. And I guess what I was going to say, the last thing is that Kia, in an interview, probably in 1987, I think, so really early on, was saying that he felt like he didn't like how, the way JRPGs were developing at the time, he was very frustrated by how there were random battles and stuff. He said, like, that doesn't make sense. Like, it should be, like, predetermined, where you know there's a monster there, you know this is where the shop is, you know this and that. And you've got to plan how you're going to get there, and that's the challenge. And whether you like that challenge or not, I don't know, but that's what it was intentional.
Is this the one where he implemented a limited number of monsters, like a finite number of monsters within the maze?
Yeah.
Yes.
So if you do too much bad karma, then you're just, that's it.
There's only so many karma-reducing potions, there's only so many everything.
And how long does it take to finish this game?
I would not know.
I don't know either. I'd have to, I mean, if you... especially on Nico Nico Doga, the Japanese equivalent of YouTube, you could probably find people going through the whole game.
I think there's like a speed run that does it in like 2 hours or something, but I don't know.
So anyway, all of this that we just described is the game that sold nearly 500,000 copies in Japan. So clearly someone enjoyed this sort of masochistic experience. And not only that, but it received expansions, it received sequels, it's still getting sequels. There was a sequel that came out this year in the US on Vita and coming up on PlayStation 4 called Tokyo Xanadu. It's not recognizable in any sense as a sequel to this, but it is an extension of the Xanadu concept in some sense.
They liked reusing the name a whole lot, which they'll revisit in the PC Engine game Legend of Xanadu, which has not very much to do with this, but they sort of were going, like, using the Xanadu name for significant games for whatever reason.
Like a prestige title.
Yeah, prestige title. Like, in 2005, its 20th anniversary game, they made Xanadu Next, which is a really good, it's like a combination between a Diablo hack and slash and a Zelda game. And it sort of takes the ideas of the mid-80s RPGs, but puts them in a modern context. And it was only released, I think, last year on Steam by Exeed, and it's an excellent game, which is definitely worth picking up.
I really need to play the Steam version of that, because the only version I played was the N-Gage version.
Yeah, it was...
Which was not excellent game. I mean, it was nice seeing the world at 4 frames per second. But.
It was bad. And then Tokyo Xanadu was just something that they brought as a 30th anniversary, but it has basically nothing to do with it. It has much more to do with the Trails of Cold Steel games. Like, it's basically an action version of that that takes place in a quasi-Tokyo.
It's kind of Trails of Cold Steel meets Persona in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
like, it feels very much like it takes a lot of cues from Persona, which, you know, like, that's pretty cool. I like that idea, but definitely has nothing to do with seeking karma points in a dark dungeon someplace.
About the expansion, they made a Xanadu scenario too, which by itself isn't really that interesting, but at that point, Yuzo Koshiro is one of the big video game music composers. He was just getting a start making his own music, and he sent a tape to Falcom, and they were like, you know what, we like it, let's use it in the game. The original Xanadu, it only had like one theme that was sort of played at like different tempos, and this one has a lot of music. And Falcom, especially over the 80s and 90s, became really well known for their range soundtrack albums. And one of the first ones they did was called All Over Xanadu, which I think was even released on vinyl and cassette tape, because it was that era, and that was its first music CD.
For a gentle audience here, we should be. What would they know Yuzo Koshiro from?
Streets of Rage.
Streets of Rage, ActRaiser, Revenge of Shinobi, Etrian Odyssey.
Surely that must be it.
The Master System version of Sonic the Hedgehog 2. Wow. Sonic the Hedgehog also. His mom's company developed it.
It's his and his mom's company.
Yeah.
It's a family business. Yeah. They're great. So anyway, that was a game called Xanadu, and boy, am I glad I missed out on that one. And I kind of feel like the next game... Okay, so there was no Dragon Slayer 3. There was a Dragon Slayer Jr., which sits in the third slot of the series, Romancia. But it's not actually called Dragon Slayer 3, is it?
No.
It's called Dragon Slayer Jr., and why would you think that is? Because it's easier? No,
but it feels like, in response to the fact that they created this game where you could spend 30 hours diving into a dungeon and then get to a point where it was unbeatable because you beat all the monsters, you used all the karma potions, and your character balance was still totally off. They created a game that had to be completed within 30 minutes.
Also, I just realized Dragon Slayer has one thing in common with Leisure Suit Larry, and that one of the numbered games is missing. And that's the joke.
Someone needs to create a Dragon Slayer. It's funny every time they do. This game, like, I, again, have never played it because who owns a PC 8801 these days in America? But, you know, going back and looking at footage of it, watching playthroughs of it, it feels almost like the inspiration for Wonder Boy 3, like the games that West One and Sega created and went in that kind of, like, action RPG vibe, that direction. Like, this is very much, like, the basis for that. And this was 1986.
Yeah. It reminds me of, like, 1000% of La Mulana, or even something like I Want to Be the Guy, just designed to screw you over at every turn.
I think it's better known here as Romancia. It's Dragon Slayer Jr. Romancia. But when it was released on Famicom, it was just called
Romancia. Yeah. And that was the first one that they actually, I don't know if it came out before for Xanadu or not, but they ported pretty much directly to the Famicom. Compile, the company that made a whole bunch of shoot 'em ups, was later known for the Puyo Puyo games. They had a working relationship with Falcom, and they ported that version of the game. And one of the main things about Romancia is that it looks and kind of plays like an RPG, but not really. It's more like an adventure game.
Tell us, how do you make an RPG that you have to finish in 30 minutes? That doesn't make any sense at all.
The game world isn't very big. But it also used the karma system, similar to Xanadu. But I mean, there's all sorts of enemies, but you're not supposed to fight any of them because they're supposed to be like regular people that were turned into monsters. Well, or something like that.
You have to fight some of them because you can't get past the. There's like a thing. Nobody tells you this in the game, but there's like a thing in the beginning, like they're the Forbidden Forest, and you go in, they can't go through the door, but you just keep killing things, and eventually, like an orb drops, and then you got that. You go through the rest of the game, and then from there, the game becomes basically doing good deeds for the town. So you get to the town, and people are sick, and you got to do you got to do a mitzvah, you know. And you got to do good deeds. So you go and get medicine, and you bring it and cure people, and then they give you a karma ring. And so I tried to play romantics. I'm like, hey, if it can be done in 30 minutes, you know, surely I could follow like a walkthrough or something, and that way I could just have finished the game before I talk about it. So I played the Famicom version, which has been translated by somebody, which does not mean you should play it, but you could. And what happened to me was like one of the things you have to do is after you cure the sick people, you have to get some angel robes, and then there's a guy on the cloud who will kill you if you ask him to. And if you have the 5 karma rings, you will go up to heaven. And then from there, you've got to do something. And I didn't get that far because you're supposed to get karma rings every time you heal somebody. But the game is so buggy that one time it just gave me a coin instead of a karma ring. So I got like 1 gold piece. And I only had 4 karma rings. And when I went to the guy who kills me, I just got a game over.
So it didn't even take 30 minutes to finish the game.
Yeah, I finished it really quickly.
Amazing.
The game world isn't that big, and I think I read somewhere that it was designed like within a month. And I don't know how big how much RAM do those things have. Like, it was technically impressive because once the game starts, it doesn't load again off a disk, which means the game itself is actually very small. I think entirely in memory.
I'm sure that was a deliberate choice by Kia. He's just one of those people who's like, I think I'll code a game this week.
Yeah, one of the reasons why Falcom
kind of like John Romero that hates you.
Not
John Romero, John Carmack.
Yeah, like one of the reasons that Falcom was so well known amongst Japanese PC players was East 3, which isn't really that impressive a game now, but it was a PTDA game that actually had multi-plane scrolling. And the fact that system could scroll at all was like really technically impressive. They used that as a selling point, much the same way for the American version, like id Software and Commander Keen, the fact that they were able to do smooth scrolling on that.
So with the next game, They kind of took a different approach. Instead of making it for a Japan-only PC, they made it for the MSX, which had some presence in Europe, and the Famicom, the NES, which, of course, was huge in the U.S. So it could be the first international Dragon Slayer. I don't know if that was deliberate or, like, the thinking there, but it definitely represented sort of the changing times. Suddenly, consoles were the games that they, you know, where people were playing their games. And so that was Dragon Slayer 4, Legacy of the Wizard. And I know some of you said you've played Legacy of the Wizard. How many of you have actually beaten Legacy of the Wizard?
A lot of people shaking their
barely,
heads.
Barely. Like, legitimately.
I was so fascinated with this game as a kid. I would rent it like a dozen times because there was 5 playable characters and like 20 items. But it was only until the age of Let's Play started that I realized this game had a point to it. That there were things you needed to do. And I was just like, oh, I was never told this.
So this is kind of an interesting game. So the idea of the game is in Japan it's called Dragon Slayer 4 Drosslay Family because it's a portmanteau of Dragon Slayer Family, Drosslay Family. And so it's got like a mama Drosslay and a papa Drosslay and a brother Drosslay and a sister Drosslay and their
puppy Drosslay
and their pet monster Pochi, which is kind of like Fido in Japanese.
That thing looks disturbingly close to Asmix Boomer character.
Yeah, right.
I wonder if there was a pending lawsuit.
So when on this
traced it from the Boomer manual.
On this slideshow, when you see this map come up, that's Legacy of the Wizard right there. When you see a map come up that looks like a giant, like a confetti pixel bomb. Okay, I'm not going to wait for it.
It'll show up.
That's the dungeon. And the dungeon is kind of divided up into kind of puzzle piece shaped segments. And each member of the family has one dungeon within the broader world. Pochi's dungeon, for instance, takes advantage of the fact that he's a monster, and the monsters do not attack him. He can't be hurt except by the boss of that dungeon. That's kind of cool. And so the idea of the game is you start out usually with Pochi, and you go and collect stuff that without getting killed. And then you come back and you finish his dungeon and then you move on to the next character. And each character has a special skill.
Yeah, and eventually you're supposed to get the Dragon Slayer sword again, and then you bring the boy.
Yeah, the only thing he's good for is using the sword.
Yeah, you just and then you fight the dragon, which you when you go to the game, you can sort of see it near the entrance of the maze, this big dragon. Like
yeah, you're like, oh, is
something.
That a painting of a dragon? No, it's actually the dragon.
Yeah, so once you have everything and you fight him, then you fight the dragon and then try to beat the game.
So yeah, back in the day, Nintendo Power was cool enough to post a password for having completed the four sections of the dungeon where you just needed to like take the kid down and beat the dragon. So I have beaten Legacy of the Wizard, but I didn't do the legwork. But it is interesting because you look, you know, when the Xanadu photo shows up and it's got the little primitive pixel art guy fighting a dragon, that's pretty much how Legacy of the Wizard is. It's like that's totally a reprise of what happened in Xanadu. So there is definitely some sort of recurring motif and themes happening here, but you really have to dig for them.
I mean, we haven't said it yet, but it's like to use the term, because there is no better term yet, Metroidvania, right? We've got Mr. Metroidvania here. I got to use it. that's what it is. And instead of one character like Samus or somebody getting all of the powers that allow them to access new parts of the maze, each one is a different character. And they have. So, for instance, the Papa Drossley, what's his name? Zem. He has a glove, right? Is it the glove?
Yeah. I think
so. And what would a glove do? Well, if you stand on a block and like press, I think you jump and then press a direction, and then the block will move. Why you need a glove to do this? You think it'd be your boots, but I don't know.
No part of that is intuitive at all.
It's once you get it, you'll never forget how to do it. But until that point, you will be furious because his dungeon is kind of like a block pushing puzzle dungeon. It's like Quirk or Sokoban or something like that. Voxel.
That is Sokoban.
I know, but some people here okay. might
I prefer
not know.
Shove it.
Yeah, shove it.
Shove it.
The warehouse game. Anyway, so that is kind of like the probably the best known entry in the Dragon Slayer series worldwide because it was released internationally by Broderbund. They kind of did like back and forth. Like they licensed a lot of their games for conversion to Japanese Famicom and then licensed Japanese games for release on the NES. So they were an important gateway to bring children of the world together and suffer under the hands of Falcom.
It really is an eccentric and gorgeous-looking game in its way. It's super colorful.
And it has a great soundtrack. That's another Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack. And like someone did a remix of that like 10 years ago and just put it up online. And that's been a permanent fixture on my iPod. I'm just dating myself.
Yeah.
On my music player device of choice. And it's just like it's great music. And it's one of the reasons that you will keep smashing your skull against this game because it looks nice and... The music when you're suffering is so good. It kind of almost makes it worthwhile.
Should we describe like the way that potions and keys and stuff work in this game?
God, I forgot about that.
I get a headache just thinking
okay,
about it.
Okay, so when you see a screenshot of the game up there, you'll see these like little basically like little meters.
Status bars.
Like, yeah, status
screen,
bars
yeah.
with like, you know, little notches in them. And so you can collect as many as, what, 100 keys? And you need keys to open everything. And you're constantly killing enemies to get drops for keys. You get your life is like done with potions, and so there's like, you know, 10 or 20
that's bread.
Oh, bread, yeah, that's
the
right.
Potions are poison. You don't
yes,
want.
Yes, that's right. It's got in it. Yeah, this is one of those games where there's this item drop that will just kill you. It harms you, and you're not supposed to get it, but it's there, and you see it all the time.
And the more health you have, the more likely it is to drop.
Right. So if you're running low on keys, you're more likely to have keys dropped. If you're running low on health, you're more likely to get... And there's magic points for it too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yep. Well, every time you attack uses magic. So you constantly
yes.
need to either keep killing things and spending magic to get it or get more money so you can buy stuff from the stores that will replenish it.
Yeah, it's usually not a problem. It's the keys that become a problem.
Unfortunately, there are a bunch of weirdos who opened up inns in the middle of this hateful dungeon. So you can stop in there and, you know, stay the night and... I'm sure they're happy for the business.
This seems like a recurring trope in RPGs this time period. It's like, well, I'm going to make my way in the world and start a tavern in the middle of this dungeon.
Wasn't there a joke in Fancy Star about it where there's like, I think you have to go to a bakery in a dungeon? What is it doing down here?
They have literally the most dangerous commute possible. You've got to be like a level 20 sorcerer or something to get to work at your pastry shop. But this is probably the first Dragon Slayer game that I would actually recommend people play. I know it's brutally difficult, but it can be finished. It is fair. in its way. And it's one of the my favorite NES games. And then we'll wrap this this conversation up and take a few questions or comments with the last, I guess, the last Dragon Slayer of the 80s, which is Dragon Slayer 5 Sorcerian.
Yeah.
After that, it's Legend of Heroes and after Lord Monarch.
Yeah, you can sort of sum those up real quick.
Yeah, but Sorcerian is kind of the last, I think, sort of notable one in that it, well, it's insane. It does the 2D platformer thing, but it gives you an entire RPG party. You create a guild of dozens of characters, and you can take four of them into the dungeon, and you get like the character train, kind of like Mickey Mousecapade, where Minnie was running behind you.
Or Mercenary Force.
Yeah. Or, you know, like Final Fantasy VIII, where you'd walk around and you'd have like the RPG train, and your dudes were just following directly in your footsteps. Almost like options in Gradius, okay? So, like, everything you do, there's always, like, a wizard and a rogue running behind you doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, in Japanese, like, the idiom for this would be, like, goldfish poop, because it's, like, it just trails after. They're, like, sycophants trailing after the leader. But you can cycle through the different characters. But, so, when you see, like, the character, like, there's, like, you'll see a character creation screen on the slideshow there, and that's how you start out. And you can create, you can create a human, you can create a dwarf, you can create an elf, I don't remember what else, but and then you have to give them their points.
Yeah,
and
there's four races and 60 role, like different jobs.
Yes,
for your 10 guild members.
Right, and then you can and then you decide how old they are, which their character portrait changes depending on whether they're young, middle aged, or elderly. And this game has so many things going on that we can probably only focus on the craziest parts, and that would be maybe more interesting than describing the gameplay, which really isn't all that great. So the age thing really factors in heavily to this, because every time between every scenario or adventure you go on, your party, like, you have the choice of, usually you want to take off a couple years. And so you can do, like, training, I think, and get stronger that way. And you earn money in the game mostly through just doing your job. And all you do is, like, you know, press a button that says something like, low a year farming or whatever. You know, it's like, that's what you're supposed to be doing. And it also has a weird thing with the age stuff, where if a character dies and then is left dead for a long time, for example, you can resurrect them and they have amazing powers or handicaps, and depending on what it is. And it's really complicated. You should just look it up because it's crazy. But like, let's say you've got like an elf and you let him die and you don't resurrect him for like 19 years, you know, in game years. Or if it's a really high number, I think he becomes immortal. And just can't die except by, like, you know, the hand of so there's weird stuff like that. It also has a spell crafting system. This is what Yoshiokiya really wanted to do, because he was really upset. Well, not upset, but really kind of getting bored with the Final Fantasy Dragon Quest style of spell casting, which is basically, I leveled up, now it's Ice 2. Ice 2! Blast the monsters with Ice 2! If you wanted to do something that's more like, let's craft spells, and like you have to learn a spell from somebody who knows it, and you have to enchant weapons, and the weapons get abilities. You want to describe how that works? Because I can't.
I can't either.
Don't ask me.
I don't know.
I mean, the other two main things about Sorcerian is that, and these are two unfortunate elements that weren't carried over really for the DOS version, was that it was very, very expandable. Like, the game comes with 15 scenarios, and you can play them, I think, in almost any order.
Once
you beat them all, then you can fight a dragon at the end. And then you can replay them as much as you want. It's just like a dungeon with different people to talk to, miniature puzzles to solve. But there were so many expansion packs made by even some third-party companies like Takeru, where there's just a different music.
Really, Takeru?
Yeah.
Huh, okay, I didn't know that. Sorry.
There were different music, you know, new graphics. There's, a Babylonian version called Gilgamesh. There's a pyramid version. This is Sengoku. A Sengoku era version of it, and this game was also ported a lot to the Mega Drive, to the PC Engine, Dreamcast. There was even a remake for Windows. And each of them, they kind of switch out, and they all have some shared scenarios, some completely new ones. So there's always something different to try. And the other thing is also the excellent Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack, which sounds really good on the PC 88, 98 synth. But when they converted it, like, the sound driver programmers at Sierra, I guess they weren't, like, a lot of American developers didn't really place a lot of emphasis on the FM synth like they did in Japan, so it doesn't sound very good at all.
They didn't have the FM synth. They were working with, like, Sound Blaster or whatever it was.
Yeah, well, like, Ad-Lib FM sort of synth.
So, yeah, so anyway, the way Kurt describes it is, I think you could look at it as, like, Sorcerian is, like, the base edition of, like, your role-playing game, and there's expansion modules to get. And that's kind of... and it has a weapon crafting or spell crafting thing where there's, what, how many? 7 different gods? And the gods all hate each other. So you can mix different... you can either keep applying the same gods, like magic spells to enchant the same item, and everything plays nicely, or you can mix gods that you don't want to be mixed and get weird effects. And there's, like, whole tables to see how this works out. And the game doesn't really even explain it to you. You just have to learn that, like, oh, now this thing I got is worthless.
Yeah, so that's pretty much, like, the weird 5-year history of Dragon Slayer in the 80s. After this, you know, you go to Legend of Heroes, which is a pretty standard Dragon Quest-style game, Final Fantasy-style game, and Lord Monarch, which is a pretty intuitive, like, not baffling and weird strategy RPG.
It's more like a real-time strategy game that predated a lot of what we know as real-time strategy games. It's not really an RPG. It's sort of like this... like a strategy game that kind of plays itself. Like, you have 4 kingdoms on a map, and your goal is to just expand your population and then conquer different parts of the map. But the idea is that controlling everybody on a granular level is too difficult because there's just too much going on. So you sort of set broad commands for each of your characters, and then rank up the speed up and down to see how well you're doing. You have to, like, adjust your tax rate, which depends on how many things you can create and how much money you actually get. It's actually pretty neat to see in action because you can set up the speed really, really high, and just if you've done everything well, you'll just see your dude smash over everything on the map. And actually, there's a version of it that was released in English, I think, called Lord Monarch Online, that you can still download from Falcom's website. That has a whole guide on how to play it and all the commands. There's no, like, storyline or anything. Even though it's developed for Windows 95, I'm pretty sure it still works on, like, Windows 10. So if you ever want to muck around with it, it's there.
Yeah, I would say this is probably the most influential game series that almost has zero traction in the West. If you look at these games, like, watch videos of them, read about them, I think you'll really be surprised by how much of these games you see in other series that you're familiar with. But, you know, because of the opacity of them, or just, you know, the nature of the platforms they were on, most of them never made their way here, and the ones that did weren't directly, like, no one drew a line between them. As a kid, I wouldn't have known that Legacy of the Wizard and Xanadu were related. So, yeah, it's like this big thing that happened and influenced a ton of other game designers in the 80s and 90s, and we're almost completely oblivious to it. So it's really fascinating to look at that way. And the games that have, like, spread out of this, you know, the Xanadu series, the Legend of Heroes series, there was the Gagarv trilogy, if that's even how you pronounce it. Like, so many games that have kind of, like, trickled their way over here, but have nothing to do really with the original series that started at all. It's pretty fascinating. So definitely something that I think anyone who's interested in game history, you know, it's worth looking into and studying a little bit. Maybe not necessarily playing, because I feel like some of these games are going to be just incredibly unfriendly and not much fun these days. But even so, there is, you know, sort of that sense of, like, roguelikes or something along those lines, where it's like, this game's not fun, but yet it's addictive. I think if they have that element to them. And I think that about wraps it. So thank you, everyone, for coming out and hearing about this very esoteric topic. Thanks, Long Island Retro Gaming Expo people, for having us here and letting us talk for an hour about this esoteric topic. And we hope we'll see you again sometime. And please continue listening to the show, Retronauts at retronauts.com, etc. So thanks. And
thanks again.
We have a few t-shirts in kind of odd sizes, if anyone would like a t-shirt. First come, first serve.
You could make one of them into a kite.